I can't understand why. But Lazarus' reference goes back to the study of inductors on a length of wire to actually bring it to resonance and to act as the next multiple with a small tail. And you have less than a half of dB of degradation of performance on the lower frequency multiple. But you don't have the bandwidth of the higher frequency of recycle. Just built one of these, and it performs excellent. The center point is at 28 feet, or one end is at 28, and the other end is at 16. Working 40 meters, maybe 250 kilohertz under 1.5, and I tuned the ends to 75 meters with about 80 kilohertz under 1.7. That's the design. That is the top section of the DXCC, which Alpha Delta claims that they invented. KD2FIU.
Very fine, George. Okay, so there's a man who has built the exact antenna, I understand correctly, with his own hands, following the W4JRW design. You got a 1.7 standing wave ratio on 80 meters, which is a far cry from 11.7 standing wave ratio. So, as you can tell, Steve, something is dead wrong. There's an open or a short circuit somewhere. And maybe the loading coil has no capacitor in it. That's perfectly all right. There's various designs like that. The word trap usually means a tuned circuit, a coil with a capacitor across it. That's the usual definition of a trap. In this case, I would not call it a trap. I would call it a loading coil because it's only an inductor. I think Howie wants to give us a couple of words before we turn it back to you, Steve. WB2HWW, K2IW, what's your latest words on this one, Howie?
Yeah, the two things I was going to say is to sweep it and find out where it resonates. Sweep the entire HF band. Now, if that's called a top hat loading coil. I call them top hats. You know, top end loading, you know, off-centered loading. Now, I would say this much. I don't know how close he brought that coil to the other wires because, remember, he made it into an inverted B. You bring that coil close to anything else, you're going to affect this inductance, Dick. You know, you may affect this near field inductance. So that could be a problem. You brought that closer to something, and that may be affecting it. Yeah, that's not a trap. Basically, a trap would be, you know, a trap for a dipole, like on a 40 and 80 meter dipole, it's set up in such a way that at resonance or at the 40 meter band, it's an open circuit. So the other, the wire of left, you know, right, you know, right of the trap, you know, the longer part on the other side of the trap is an open circuit at 40. And when you're on 80, the trap basically is a short. It's just basically it has no effect. It's transparent. So that's basically, you know, we all know how a trap works. But this is a top-end loaded coil fit. So I have a funny feeling that if you were to bring that coil near something, you would basically affect its loading. And because it's got such low resistance, Dick, that tells me that for some reason the antenna looks very short. That means that the antenna looks like less than a half wave. You know, the shorter the antenna, the lower the feed impedance R is going to be. So I would assume something is making that antenna look like a short. Does he have a break in the wire? That's hard because you would physically see that. But if you got only 7 ohms of resistance, R is equal to 7 ohms, that tells me the antenna is awfully short, Dick.
Oh, Steve.
I don't agree, Andy. I mean, Howie. He's measuring 7 ohms in the shack after 230 feet of coax cable, which is giving him an impedance inversion. I'm working out the mathematics on that right now. At the other end of that transmission line, to get 7 ohms in the shack, it might be 700 ohms at the antenna, so to speak. It's some very different impedance. Henry, if you wanted to kill that coil, and you put a great big chunk of metal inside of the coil itself, yes, you could kill a lot of its inductance. On the outside of that coil, bringing it close to another piece of wire, yeah, if it's 120 microhenry and you bring it real close to a piece of wire, you'll bring it down to 118 microhenries, if you know what I mean. It's a very minor effect. That's not it. I can't believe that's it. So he's looking for something that's much more drastic. We're looking for a rather complete failure here, like a complete open circuit on that loading coil. And maybe we can check that with an ohmmeter. Sometimes you can get a very good-looking mechanical joint by visual inspection, but it might be an open circuit. Let me pass it back to Steve if he's got some further words so far. KD2HUC, K2RIW on TechNet. You've got it there, Steve.
I sent you a link to the manual on this antenna, but I'm sorry, the gentleman who was talking about the history of this antenna, he made a comment how many feet of wire are beyond the trap. Can he come back and tell me again how long that wire is supposed to be? Because I thought he said like 5 feet, and there's not 5 feet of wire on the end of those traps. So if he could come back and tell me again what how long that wire is supposed to be, because it doesn't say in the manual.
How many feet of wire do you think is beyond the loading coil, Steve? Go ahead.
Off the top of my head, I would say less than that. I would say 2.5-3 feet. So I don't know how big of a difference.
K2UPS.
Oh, what the hell?
Yeah, George told us 4 feet. He said that the tails are roughly 4 feet, and you're measuring 2.5 to 3. That's the right ballpark. KTUPS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich. Wait for the beeps.
Okay, good. KTUPS Mobile. I've used that antenna before at my house, and it's also one up at my local club. I had looked at the manual before when he started discussing it, and it had 3 wires on it on each side. The longest wire, or the uppermost wire, is the 15, 40, and 80, and that wire comes from Alpha Delta at about 41 feet. Supposedly that they pre-tune it. It does say in the manual that you may have to solder on some wire onto the end to get it to be on 80 where you need it, but it should be about 41 feet total length for the longest wire that has the, and they call them ISO-RES coils, ISO-RES coils. That's their terminology for it. And then there's a 20-meter wire below that and a 10-meter wire below that. But the longest wire, the one that handles 80 meters, should be about 41 feet on each side.
Very good information, Rich. Does that sound about right there, Steve? 41 feet of wire total on each side, including a 4-foot tail after the loading coil. KD2HUC, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's definitely in the ballpark, Dick. That's about right.
Okay, you've got the right antenna. If I understand correctly, Rich KTUPS has used it, got reasonable standing wave ratio. George has built it with his own hands and got reasonable standing wave ratio. So the design has got history. Lots of people have built, bought, or whatever, that exact antenna. And the fact that you've made it a folded dipole and not exactly the right number of feet above the ground, those are all red herrings from my point of view. And even if the loading coil is close to another piece of wire, that's a red herring. To kill a real inductor made out of 14-gauge wire that's giving you 100 to 120 microhenries, to kill that inductor, it has to put a great big chunk of metal in the middle of that coil. On the outside of that coil, if you laid that coil up against a sheet of metal, as long as it was a couple of inches away, it would still have 90% of that inductance, if you know what I mean. Most of the real magnetic field of that coil is concentrated inside the coil, and you're not putting a foreign substance inside of that coil. I'm working out the mathematics right now of what's going on with 120 feet, correction, 130 feet. You've got 230 feet of coax, and you've told us what impedance you measured in the shack. And in a few more minutes, maybe when we go over to Eric, I'll work out the mathematics as to what the apparent impedance is right at the antenna. That's going to give us another clue. And I think answer is going to be an extremely high impedance, like an open circuit. So something is not making contact, even though it looks like it is a guess on my part, Steve. Back to you for any final comments. We'll go over to Eric, pick him up with his deep subject, and then we'll come back to you if you're still around. KD2HUC, KQRIW in TechNet. You've got it, Rich. Correction, here we go, Steve.
All right, sounds good, Dick. In the meantime, while you talk to Eric, I'm gonna take some more measurements and see what I can find here. It's nighttime, so I can't really look at the antenna. I don't want to try and lower it right now, but I'll sweep the entire band and see what it looks like.
Good piece of information. I guess you're gonna. It's only the 80 meter band we care about. So when you sweep 80 meters, 3.5, 3.6, 3.7, 3.8, 3.9, 4.0. That's going to tell you 90% of what we want to know. Okay, now we're going to go over to the deep dive with Eric. KE2EJ, KE2EJ, the deep diver, KE2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
KE2RIW, KE2EJ. All right, I'm actually making some converters. I was going to ask you, what would you use, or how would you calculate band pass filters, say for example I'm making a doubler. I've built some stuff from Ethernet microwave in the past. What's the best way, besides using a program, to come up with the size, the amount of copper traces that one would need in a filter in this type of chain? So IWK2J.
Okay, if I understand correctly, you're building a filter on printed circuit board, strip line or whatever. You're trying to ask me what width or standing wave ratio, you know, what VC0 of transmission line to make a filter. And you said microwave filter. So I'm a bit confused here. Sounds to me like you're not following somebody else's good recipe, a known good design. It sounds like this is a Spiegel original coming up. And what frequency you're designing a filter? Is it a band pass filter, a band stop filter, trap? And so what materials are you using at what frequency, and what response are you trying to get, Eric? And I'm not a filter maven. KE2EJ, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Hi. We're generating, actually I've made from actually in this case it's going to be a DSS. I'm going to come up with, say, 1.2 gigs, and I want to multiply that by 2. And I am going to need some type of filter, be a band pass filter, or a band stop filter. Take that 1.2 that's going to be rich in harmonics to leave me with 2.4. I want to do this on a PC board, and it's going to be a strip line type of configuration. So I've seen a lot of different formulas and a lot of different ideas on how to go about this. I mean, I could copy, say, I have a converter that's from Eastern Microwave, physically copy the dimensions of something similar. And I want to calculate it out and work the numbers out and come up with a design that works in my particular system. And it doesn't have to necessarily be a copy of someone else's method of doing it. I know of a number of strip line programs which I can't afford to buy that would give me precisely the layout. Whereas this type of strip line filter can look like, you know, for lack of having a better way of saying it, could look like three tuning forks, one next to each other. So IWK2J.
I don't know if I can help you on this one, Eric. I don't have a great deal of experience of homebrewing filters of the kind that you're discussing. I do recommend you, you do some literature search to find out who has built filters of the kind you're looking for at the frequency region you're looking for. It's nice to start off with somebody else's known design that's got some real track record and some real history to it. Because every engineer would like to build his own circuit, his own design. and almost all good new ideas do not work at first. You have to pull quite a bit of the strands of hair out of your head in order to get rid of all the bugs and almost anything you build that's homebrew the first time. And filters certainly fall into that category because there's a lot of art and science that goes into a filter, some of which is not obvious. Mattai, Young, and Jones is a great big fat book that you probably know about, which has got a zillion filter designs in there. So I would start off looking at your favorite issue. Go to your bookshelf, pick up your copy of that great big fat book, Mattai, Young, and Jones, and look at the filters they've got in there, Eric. Find the one that comes close to the frequency region and the type that you're looking for. KE2EJ, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Okay. I was hoping you would have a nice smart answer to me. Actually, in my hands, I have little cavities that I've built that does the job, but I want to put this down on a PC board and not have it have all this dimension. There's various different kinds of broadband passive filters.
It is.
Basically, you know, strips of, you say strips of PC board on FR4 type of substrate. Well, they have some newer substrates that the dielectric conscious are a lot better, but that'll work. I mean, I kind of figured I can, in essence, try and calculate the inductances of a specific amount of thickness of material, you know, 1 ounce material. And in essence, calculate the inductance of each one and, in theory, put them together. But then there's this issue of mutual coupling from one to the next that I really don't have a clue about. And there are some books that I've run across that don't do a great job of explaining it. Although there are a number of computer programs that pretty much everybody uses to do this kind of calculation for you. But, oh well, I will do my research and eventually I'm sure I'll come up with something. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Yeah, I was fiddling with my calculator while you were giving the raw information. So, once again, if I understand correctly, it is the 2.7 or 2.4 gig frequency region. If I understand correctly, you're trying to make a broadband bandpass filter. What are you trying to reject? Is it things that are a couple hundred megs away that you're trying to reject? So, run it by one.
That's a multiplier. If I'm starting out with, you know, a dirty 1.2, I want to make a clean 2.4.
So you're starting off with an oscillator at 31 megs, you're multiplying, and it's a harmonic at 2.4 gigs, and you want to pass that and reject the nearest multiple 31 megs away. Is that what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead.
That's kind of the right idea. I can successfully make the 1.2. Actually, I have a CSS and a DDS and a VCO and a phase lock loop. Actually, I think I showed you that. It generates 1.2 gigs with a resolution of 1 hertz if I feed it by GPS.
Wow. Resolution of 1 hertz, and this is a, if I understand correctly, this is a synthesized, it's a frequency multiplier assembly, probably starting off with a crystal oscillator and multiple stages of doubling and tripling, and you're trying to produce either 1,200 or 2,400 megs of final output, and you want all undesired products to be 40 dB down. Is that sort of what you're looking for, Eric?
Yeah, that's kind of it. Actually, the reference for this is 10 megahertz GPS lock, but I don't have a GPS. I have a little crystal oscillator. This is pretty damn close to 10 megahertz. But GPS is the way to go. And it's a DDS. It's a direct digital synthesis, which in turn drives the reference into a phase detector, which is connected to a VCO that operates in the range from 900 to 1.5, 1.6. No, runs from 950, sorry, 950 to 1.99. It's a little mini circuit thing. And actually, the phase noise out of this thing is, as far as I can tell, pretty unbelievable.
Now, I presume this is acting as a local oscillator for some kind of a receiver. and as long as the bandpass of the RF circuitry is good enough, you could tolerate some pretty strong undesired products of that local oscillator. And then when you mix down the IF, they're going to fall out of the region. So maybe these undesired products you're trying to filter out, maybe they're not, not giving you any harm, Eric. Go ahead.
Well, okay. I've got to take the 1.2 that I have is absolutely pure and make it ring so I can get 2.4, 4.8, etc., so on and so forth, and also going the other direction.
Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about here. You and I are very familiar with the physical appearance of an IC2AT, ICOM handy-talkie, thumb wheel switches, 1983 design, and I own about three or four of them. Study what that thing is doing. The phase lock loop in there is running at 72 megahertz, roughly, running at half the desired frequency into the mixer. It's allowing the mixer to do the second harmonic generation. The RF amplifier in front of that makes sure that 144 to 148 megacycles goes into it. But the local oscillator in that rig runs at 72 megacycles. At first you'd think to yourself, wow, when you're running at the subharmonic frequency into the mixer, you're going to get 6 dB of extra loss, yeah. But if you've got enough RF amplification, you don't give a damn. And if you've got enough bandpass filtering, you don't give a damn. So, I mean, there's an example of what the average person would say is the world's worst local oscillator for that mixer, yet that rig works like a charm. So in many cases, the undesired products coming out of your synthesizer could be a red herring, as long as you got the right RF bandpass filter and the right IF frequency afterwards. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
2RIW, KE2EJ. Now, I understand fully what you're saying, but this particular synthesizer that I built, it was designed to be pretty much harmonic free. The sine wave that comes out of it is pretty damn pure. And the only kind of disturbances I see is even more than 60 dB down. I have enough trouble measuring it.
Yeah, have enough trouble measuring it. Once I knew that the handy-talkie IC2AT is running at 72 megs, and a little bit of leakage comes out of that cabinet, a microwatt, and because I was using a service monitor, it happened to be a Hewlett-Packard, they don't call it service monitor, but it was a Hewlett-Packard service monitor, tuned to 72 megs, and the IS strip somewhere downrange, I managed to put that into a dynamic signal analyzer, a Hewlett-Packard 3561, which can go down to millihertz of bandwidth. So I had a synthesized local oscillator on the service monitor, listening to 72 megacycles. The antenna into the service monitor was a little piece of wire, a piece of bus bar stuck into the connector. That was the antenna. And because of the great synthesizer, because of the millihertz of res bandwidth that I could get out of the dynamic signal analyzer, looking at the IF strip coming out of the service monitor, I had somebody take that handy-talkie in AIL and start walking away from me. To make a long story short, he went to the other end of the building, half a mile away. I'm listening to the leakage signal, a microwatt of leakage signal at 72 megs coming out of that handy-talkie, and I'm watching it on that screen of the dynamic signal analyzer. He calls me on the telephone from the other end of the building. I have him turn the rig on and off to make sure I'm not looking at a birdie. When you've got a narrow enough filter and a good enough spectral purity of the local oscillator, you're amazed how weak a signal you can listen to. I was doing an experiment not too different from what NASA is doing when they're listening to the Voyager spacecraft at 13 billion miles. K2EJ,
repeater, timeout.
K2EJ, K2RIW, you got it, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. All right, well, I built this thing. It's got plus 10 coming out of it. It could help me really strong signal. You know what? I think I'm going to take that, put it to a mixer, my 2.4 in one side, feed my 1.2 in the other side, with maybe like 100 megahertz difference or 50 megahertz difference and see if I get the product that I'm intending to find. And if I do, then I'll amplify it. And if I don't, I gotta rethink this whole thing.
Yeah, since you know exactly what frequency components by way of your spectrum analyzer exist on the current multiplier assembly you're using right now, you know that's going to go into the local oscillator port of a mixer. You know what RF frequency range you're listening to on the RF port of the mixer. Therefore, you can predict what the IF is going to look out on the output, as long as you've got a reasonable IF amplifier and bandpass filter. You may be in Fat City, and the fact that your oscillator has other artifacts, other frequency components, could very well be a red herring. If you have extremely broadband frequency range RF light coming in, DC to light, yes, you're going to get some phony responses, but you probably already have a restricted frequency region of the RF that's coming in. By the way, with reference to Rich, Chris and Steve, KD2HUC, 230 feet of RG8 coax cable, which I think has got a velocity factor of 69%, at 3750, which you believe that's 1.27 wavelengths long. His transmission line is 1.25 wavelengths long, which gives him all kinds of inversion going on. So we'll soon find out what his measured impedance, what it really means at the antenna. It's going to be something wild. Over to you for now, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW. You can predict what you're going to get, I think.
Alright, K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, I give this a shot. I have an idea that turned out to be interesting. I mean, I've got these little, I build things in little blocks, so I've got a mixture that works very well at those frequencies. So I see what kind of results I get out of it. The way I currently do it now with the cavities, I have a hot carrier diode. Really probably could use a tunnel diode or something at those frequencies, but it gives me enough harmonics to play with my cavities. My cavities work pretty well, so I'll let you know what happens. It's another one of those long term things that every couple of months I pick it up and do a little more. QRW, K3J.
Okay, let us know what you find out. Sounds like an interesting experiment. Your overall requirement here is you're building a receiver with all the access you've got to commercial equipment. I'm amazed you can't pick up one of the pieces of equipment you've got in your stock room, so to speak, and make a minor modification to listen to the frequency you want to listen to. Over to you on that one, Eric, K2RIW.
Now, interestingly enough, my goes down converter is actually a C-band, the C-band LNB that I modified and brought it down. That works pretty damn well.
Yeah, if you start up with somebody's commercially made equipment, and even though you've got to make it move it a whole lot of megacycles away from where it was originally tuned, start up with somebody's commercial equipment, retune it, modify it, and make it do what you want, I think is a hell of a lot faster and easier than starting from scratch to build your own oscillator, build your own mixer, and so on. So I'm a little bit curious as to why you want to homebrew so much of the circuit, Eric, go ahead.
Well, I think it's about 4 or 5 years ago, I was reading an article about direct digital synthesis and how you can use that to run another device which is running another VCO and have a very stable, clean output directly on the frequencies that I'm interested in. So I built that. I've used that for quite a number of things. Now I want to be able to listen to some satellite downlinks. Yes, I could go buy a converter from Downing's Microwave. Actually, I have a couple of them right here on the bench. I've got one local oscillator that starts out with 188 megahertz crystal, and it takes me up to 2.4. It's fancy. It'll do the job in terms of receiving, but I'm trying to do two things. One, have decent sensitivity, and two, have extremely low phase noise because I wanted to code some digital stuff. And kind of reminds me of the days that I was working for the Gravis lab, and we're doing some interesting stuff in the military, and it was rather intriguing in those days because they had the transistors and stuff that we have today. And, you know, in those days it was very expensive stuff. Well, I'm not trying to do the same thing, but same sort of end result with as fewer parts as possible.
I watched an awful lot of the hand-pulling that existed at AIL when they first started working on direct digital synthesizers way back in the late 80s, early 90s. And the good news is the DDS can give you some great resolution. However, at specific frequencies that you tune the DDS to compared to your reference, you look at it on the spectrum analyzer, and boy, it makes a Christmas tree worth of artifacts. At certain frequency regions you tune through, you see a whole bunch of upper and lower sidebands, so to speak, that move closer and further apart as you tune it.
But you know, how many bits were you talking about in those days?
Darn good question. Probably only 8 bits. And if I knew you, and if I know you, you're probably synthesizing with 16 bits. Is that true, Eric?
24.
Wow. Okay. When you're synthesizing with that many bits, as long as your D to A and A to D has the right kind of resolution and attack time and whatever, the nice thing about a DDS, you can switch from frequency A to frequency B in microseconds, maybe nanoseconds. It's got a lot of adaptability along those lines.
You still get aliasing. You got to watch out for that.
Yeah, I saw an awful lot of aliasing on that screen. And in some cases, those aliases are packed in so close that they're beyond the region where you can filter them out, Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, that's why when you use your calculation, you figure out where your Nyquist is and you know what your limits are. You can minimize that to a pretty extreme, where the device that I built is, even as you change its frequency in real time, the aliasing products are so small you don't even see them.
Are you talking about like 60 dB down?
Well, my spectrum analyzer I trust is good to 100, and I can't see them.
So, when you set the analyzer just right, you've got instantaneous dynamic range on screen of 100 dB. And usually when you set it for 100 dB, you're not sweeping very far in frequency. So at least in close, you're saying you saw no undesired products for 100 dBc. If that's what you're saying, that's impressive.
You know what? Now I have the... I haven't actually put it on the digital signal analyzer that I have. You know, I can even set that thing up for a bandwidth of 1 hertz. That's another interesting thought. But yeah, no, the stuff that I had, I mean, I would trust it to minus 80. And, you know, it's all noise down there. And, you know, with this new digital signal analyzer that I had, that, by the way, which goes up to the 9 gig. Yeah, I wanted them to buy the 20 gig one, but... we don't have any microwaves up there anymore. Now, speaking of microwaves, I'm working on a 6 gig path between here and the World Trade Center, which I'll be putting that dish up in another couple of weeks. So I've ordered some special adapters and some circulators to add this to the chain, because they're going to keep both of them going at the same time. It's on different frequencies, of course, but that's another fun project. K2RWP, do that.
Out of curiosity, Eric, why are you setting up a 6 gig link to the Empire, or a new World Trade Center, the new Freedom Tower? Out of curiosity, how come you're not getting the data you want from them by way of a piece of fiber?
Yeah, for a couple of reasons. I don't know what your experience with fiber delivery is. Do you have any?
you're going to tell me something that right now I'm naive and I think fiber is great.
Now, when you're running a broadcast facility that's running 24 hours a day and the signal absolutely, positively has to be there, and you've got companies like Verizon, Lightpath, and what used to be called Time Warner, every now and then they'll be in their office doing patching things, and all of a sudden your signals are missing. You need to be able to get around that. So, yes, fiber is the main form of signal delivery, which actually comes from here and goes to World Trade and Four Times Square and currently Empire. But you need a backup system. Also, I pass other types of data, which, since my microwave doesn't cost me anything, and when you're buying fiber, you're paying for bandwidth, and I've got more bandwidth in my microwave than I have in the fibers that we're buying. It makes sense to have a good backup path, don't you think?
Yes, it does. But when it comes to the data that you're receiving, that you're about to broadcast, I would guess that if at all possible, you try to avoid live broadcast. Most of what you intend to broadcast, you've received it the day before, you put it on a hard disk, you know that you've got it, and now under actual broadcast, you're simply playing that hard disk. If at all possible, you try to avoid live broadcast. Isn't that true, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW?
Oh, are you suggesting at each transmitter site we have a hard disk and feed everything into it a couple days before and then let it transmit in real time as long as that hard disk is right next to the transmitter?
That's what I thought you're doing, Eric. I thought most of what goes out over the air from you at that instant is being played back from a hard disk, and that hard disk might even have a backup to that.
No, actually, those words are quite true, except that the disk that's playing happens to be up in Syracuse. Although we have something called the DR, disaster relief, whereas I have, and not in the room with the transmitter, in the other room, you've been here, there's actually a server that actually has a week's worth of programming on it. But because the stuff on TV is somewhat dynamic, and we have stuff that's live all the time, like, say, the news hour, it ain't on disk because it's being generated at that particular moment. As an example, what they call a joint master control, or the place where programming come from, in Syracuse, they provide the programming for Hawaii Public Television. They provide a couple of actual commercial networks around the country. So there are edge servers, as we call them, but they tend to be in the studios or in the facility where the people are and not the transmitters. We're going to drop. So most broadcasters, if they can afford it, will have more than one path to their transmitter. It'll be from the studio to the transmitter. The actual hard disk device, well, if you want to go back a few years, companies like SeaChange and others, the hard disk uses RAID 5, RAID 7 types of configuration. That'll usually take up like, you know, 4 or 6 racks. Actually, today it's getting smaller. You can get, if you're only storing what we call ASI, or an asynchronous serial stream, which is the format that your TV receiver is getting, you only need 20 megabits per second. If you're a studio and you're storing the stuff out of your cameras, you need 1.16 gigabits per second, and that gets to be an awful lot of many terabytes of stuff for a day's worth of programming, so that's a heck of a lot of big drives. And if you're doing, you know, a RAID system and a backup RAID system, you need some physical space for it. Although, again, it's getting smaller, but it still takes up space. And generally, you put that where your engineering department is, or within your facility. And most transmitters today are completely unmanned, so there's nobody there to react when something happens. So that's why it's good to have more than one path to your transmitter.
Now, I assume that the NewsHour program was really recorded an hour ahead of time, and that I can see it replayed at 11 o'clock and then again at 3 o'clock in the morning, and it's the identical program. I assume that when I'm seeing it, I'm looking at a rather fresh recording, but I think it's a recording. Are you telling me sometimes Rafael Pierremont and all the others are on NewsHour or really, truly live at that instant at, say, at 7 o'clock? Wait a minute. They first go on channel 21 at 6 o'clock. Are you saying at 6 p.m. local time it's truly live? Over to you, Eric, KTRIW. Yeah, it
is. Well, not Rafael Pierremont. You're talking about Metro Focus. That's what you're referring to. I do that at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, or 1 o'clock in the afternoon. No, the news hour that comes out of Washington, the news hour weekend that comes from us at a Lincoln Center, I forget which one is the first. Either it's on WNET or LIW first, but anyway, the first time you see it, it's live. After that, of course, it's a replay.
Yeah, it's on LIW first. 6 o'clock, channel 21-1 is when it first comes on. And then you'll see it again on channel 13 at 7 o'clock local time. And it's the identical program. So you're telling me at 6 o'clock on LIW, it's truly live at that instant. Boy, there are so few on-air errors. I assume that it has already been recorded and the bloopers have been removed, is what I thought.
Nope. Actually, local news on NBC, CBS, that's still live. National news is live on the East Coast anyway, and then, of course, it's delayed for the West Coast and Mountain Time, Central Time. That's one of the few things TV stations do these days is news, and it's live. It ain't, you don't get to, even assuming that you pre-recorded it and you want to edit and stuff like that, you need time for that. And I'm sure if you think about it, you've seen them mess up on the air. It happens all the time.
The bloopers that I've seen are so minor. I thought they occurred originally and didn't think it was worth editing them out. A dumb question I got for you, Eric, that I should know. Polyethylene coax, RG-213. RG-8, is that velocity factor 64%, 65%, 60%? What is the velocity factor of polyethylene coax? I'm guessing it's 69%, but right now I'm not sure. Over to you, Eric.
Give me a second and I can give you the actual number. I think it's a little higher than that. I think that it's 70, but that'll give you the answer.
Yeah, the 70s is Teflon. Polyethylene is in the 60s, I think. It's either 65 or 69%.
KD2INS.
KD2INS. Part of your name, sir. K2LIW. My name is Dick.
Roger. Hello, Dick. How you doing? You know me. We met at Bubba's barbecue. Name is Bob. Copy.
About 72%, Dick.
Polyethylene cable, 72%. Wow. Go right ahead, Bob.
I got a off-the-wall question. I was given a four-band Hustler HF antenna. Now, on the top, there's a little 3/8 24 screw. Now, I was wondering if I put another 20 meg, it's a high gain 20 meg loading coil on top of that, and then put another antenna on top of that, if it would work.
Okay. I've heard a bunch of words, but right now I don't have enough raw information to know what you're doing. Is this a mobile antenna? Were you putting something on top of the spring mount, so to speak? What's going on here, Bob?
It's a base station antenna. It's a 4BTV. Four-band vertigo antenna. And what I want to do is I'm going to try to bring it down to 80 meters. So right now it does 10, 15, 20, and 40. And I want to bring it down to 80 meters. And I was wondering if I screw in another 20 meg coil on top of the, there's like there's a 3/8 24 stud on top for another resonating antenna. So I was wondering if I could just make one. If I screwed a 20 meg coil on top of that and then put a 6-foot antenna, do you think it'll work?
If you put a big enough loading coil on an antenna that's too short, can you make it resonate, meaning get rid of the reactive component on 80 meters? Absolutely. So with a big enough loading coil, you can get rid of the reactive component. Are you going to be happy with the resistor component that's left over? Right now, we don't know. And there's a way you can predict that by way of the Brown and Woodward curves, if you know what I mean by that. In other words, Chapter 4 of every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. Well, you can go to the website, amateurradio.tv or LimeOnTechNet.com.
K-2-U-P-S.
We have more information for you, Tim.
Okay, so you can predict from your length of your radiator exactly what impedance you're going to get by way of those curves. If you've got the right kind of an antenna tuner, all of that goes away. By way of the antenna tuner, you'll get an exact impedance match no matter what the hell the antenna is. K2UPS, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Hey, good evening. It's in Pennsylvania now. I have that antenna right now in my backyard, the four-band trap vertical, and they make Hustler cells in addition to that to make it resonant on 80 meters. But just by adding, he would have to add a homebrew 40-meter trap at the top and then the right length whip and, you know, get lucky with his calculations to have that work out to save himself a lot of grief. If he really wants to get on 80 meters with that, I would suggest buying the add-on that comes from Hustler. But just be aware that it's extremely narrow bandwidth. You're not going to get much bandwidth out of that on 80 meters.
Darn good information, Rich. And whenever you take an antenna that's much too short and you force it into resonance by way of an antenna tuner, loading coils, or whatever, it's going to be high in Q. It's going to be very narrow. KD2INS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay, thank you very much for the information, you know. And take it easy, and I'll talk to you another day. KD2INX, we're clear.
Good luck with that experiment, Bob. Let us know how it works out. Eric, I think it's a high 60% region is the real velocity factor of RG8 coax. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Actually, I have a list here of some various different coaxes and their velocity factors. But I also have a listing of the dielectrics themselves, and solid polyethylene is 65.9, foam polyethylene is 80, foam polystyrene is 91, airspace polystyrene somewhere between 84 and 88, solid Teflon is 69.4, airspace Teflon, that's like the stuff I use in my transmission line, running between 85 and 90. But let me give you the specifics, like Belden 9913 version of RG8 is 84, and 8214, which is the foam Belden, is 78. 8237, which is polyethylene, that's 66. So your numbers are right, but they vary. The foam Belden was 81, another polyethylene RG6 is 66. So you can see it varies according to the dielectric.
So let's find out from Steve directly. Steve, you've got 230 feet of feed line. Is almost all of that really RG8U polyethylene, solid polyethylene coax? KD2HUC, K2RIW?
I would assume so, Dick. That's, it wasn't Belden. I don't remember what the manufacturer was on it. I think the vendor I got it from was MP Digital. But it's been in the ground for a couple of years now, so I don't really remember, the brand.
So is it foam or is it a clear, solid, plastic-looking thing?
I bet you it's solid polyethylene. Is that true, Rob? I mean, Steve.
Yeah, it's definitely solid polyethylene. It's not foam.
Yeah, foam in the ground, flexible cable would be very troublesome. It would slowly be absorbing water. Polyethylene is very forgiving on water buried in the ground without a piece of conduit. So I think it's going to be either 66 or 69%.
Hey, you're looking at 66.
Okay, 66 is the number. And therefore, he's got a little bit more than 1 1/4 wavelengths on 80 meters, which is giving him a pretty wild impedance aversion. We'll talk about that pretty soon. Okay, we're about to go to the space report. Is anybody else with any final questions before we do that? KQLAW.
By the way, polyethylene is 1.54 nanoseconds per foot.
Okay, and since the velocity factor is 1 over the square root of the dielectric constant, or 1.54 nanoseconds. Yeah, that tells us velocity factor also, because air is very close to 1 nanosecond per foot. Okay, let's go over to the space report. Paul, I know that there was a lot of cheering and crying and whatever took place at Pasadena at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory because of what happened at Saturn. A beautiful spacecraft decided to commit suicide and dove itself right into the planet, into the atmosphere at something like 60,000 miles an hour. WS2N, K2LIW, go right ahead, Paul.
This is WS2N. Yeah, Cassini's mission has come to an end. And yeah, I watched the people at JPL on Friday morning. That was live on NASA TV. So I watched that on the computer. And fun to watch with a cup of coffee at 7:45 when I took a dive into the atmosphere. They said around 70,000 miles per hour. And it went exactly, you know, almost to the second that they predicted that it would burn up. So that's the end of a 13-year orbital mission. Been in orbit since 2004. We are 13 years later. It took off in, what, 1997. So this is really a 20-year mission as far as being active. It took them 7 years to get that spacecraft in orbit around Saturn. And so actually 2004, end of 2004, and then the very beginning of 2005, they released the Huygens spacecraft built by the European Space Agency. So they were part of it, part of the whole development of this thing. And that Huygens lander had a parachute, heat shield and a parachute, and wound up soft landing on Titan, that moon, that largest moon around Saturn, that's completely socked in with nitrogen clouds. You know, you can't even, if you were orbiting it, you couldn't see the ground. The reason they know what it looks like, that it has so many lakes, and methane lakes, and ethane, big lakes, maybe as big as lakes of Superior, is because Cassini made, over the years, 127 passes, and over that time it used its radar to look below the surface, below the cloud cover. Let me drop it. And that was predicted in one of Carl Sagan's earlier books, that maybe that planet had a methane lake, that you could actually put a boat there and float around on it. And someday they plan on doing something like that, bringing a spacecraft to Titan, having some type of boat floating on the surface, maybe a rover on the land, you even put balloons in the atmosphere. You can do anything you want on Titan. So that was one of the biggest discoveries, because the only two spacecraft that went past, three spacecraft that went past Saturn was Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, and also Pioneer 10. Pioneer 11. 10 went past Jupiter, 11 went past Saturn. So, big difference in pictures between Pioneer 11 and then Voyager, and they thought Voyager was great. And of Cassini, Cassini had 13 years in orbit to really bring all kinds of science home. They discovered that the North Pole had this hexagonal cloud cover as the planet would spin. To look at the North Pole and see the hexagon look. They finished up with the dramatic end. They wanted to go between the rings, right between the lower, the smallest rings, and then deorbited the atmosphere. Another big discovery was before they ever knew anything about a small moon called Enceladus. Only about 300 miles in diameter. They found out that this planet has water vapor shooting out of the planet. So that was a big surprise. They actually sent Cassini on a couple of the passes right through the water vapor to detect what it was made of and what kind of hydrocarbons were made out of it. They did find some kind of H2. They said it. H2 is some kind of a sign that there might be something biological in the inside of Enceladus. They won't know, of course, until many years from now when they return. They do have plans of returning. They burnt up Cassini because they didn't want it to land on a crash into one of the moons going around Saturn. It was never designed to land or do that. If it was, they would decontaminate it. They'd bring all the equipment up to a couple hundred degrees Celsius and for like 40, 50 hours and decontaminate everything before they would send it out. They've done that to the rovers and, you know, that have gone to Mars and all. But they don't do it to an orbital spacecraft like Cassini or... Well, Galileo was the same type of deal. That orbited Jupiter for quite a few years. They did the same thing with Galileo and burnt that up into the atmosphere as well. I think that went in like 100,000 miles per hour. Let me drop. They have a couple of missions planned now, some years from now, before they can launch these things. I think the earliest one would be 2022. But between the United States and the European Space Agency, ESA is planning on something called the JUICE mission. I forgot what it stands for, but that mission, they plan on orbiting planets many times Saturn. And Jupiter. They plan on going back to Jupiter on a deep space mission. So they're going to investigate that. But as far as Saturn goes, they don't have any immediate plans. They have immediate plans to go back to Jupiter. Although, from what I read, that you know, they're working on plans for Saturn. They want to eventually go to, maybe even land on Enceladus or go back to Titan. There's nothing funded for that, but Jupiter there is. They have juiced by the European Space Agency. And they plan on eventually going into orbit with their spacecraft around one of the moons called Ganymede. You want to check out the magnetic field of Ganymede. It's the only one in the whole solar system besides us that has it's the only moon that has a magnetic field, and they want to look into that. So there's a lot of deep space missions that's going to be planned. We have the Europa Express, Europa Clipper. I'm sorry, that's what it's called. Europa Clipper. WS2N. They plan on going around Jupiter about 40 orbits around that planet. And each time they go by near Europa, they'll plan on, you know, taking close-up pictures of that. And maybe even have a lander on it. Some guys want a lander, but right now that's not funded. But that would be interesting. Okay, getting back to Saturn, all I can say is the scientists are itching to go back.